In the very heart of Mexico, in the center of the two great American continents, there is enshrined upon a great high altar one of the most beloved, most treasured, most venerated objects in all of Christendom, a small cloak made of cactus fiber so thin one can see through it. For over 450 years, this little cloak, or tilma, as it is properly called, has attracted the attention of millions of pilgrims from all over the world, many of them walking the last mile on their knees, singing and praying aloud for the privilege of kneeling before it. Replicas of this tilma and the image upon it adorn our churches. It brightens the homes of the humble poor and sobers the mansions of the very rich. If you live in Southern California, as I do, you cannot go anywhere without seeing it in shops, on car bumper stickers, on t-shirts, sweatshirts, and billowing skirts, on billboards, tattooed on the arms of construction workers, and even carved on a tree along the road. Perhaps no other religious object after the crucifix itself draws so much veneration. There is something to be gained in the telling and retelling of this account, like the beautiful Christmas story we never tire of, and the wonderful tales of the noble deeds of the saints, which are told and retold and handed down from one generation to another. The story begins over 400 years ago. The place is a barren hill in central Mexico, not far from the large metropolis now known as Mexico City. But perhaps we are ahead of ourselves. The story really begins with the arrival of Captain Hernando Cortes and the Spanish fleets in the southern part of the New World in 1519. As Cortes and his soldiers penetrated the vast green plains and sandy deserts of Mexico, they found some 10 million inhabitants comprising different tribes of Indians living there. The controlling rulers were the Aztecs, who had incorporated the various tribes into a vast empire under the authority of a single man. Each Aztec province was individually ruled by a governor who levied taxes, directed the interchange of trade, and controlled the army. The Aztec Empire had a rigid caste system ranging from the emperor, the nobles, chief priests, and judges, down to the working classes, unskilled laborers, and slaves. Agriculture was a leading industry, and corn the chief crop. Reading and writing were limited to a pictograph system similar to the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. As far as their architectural skills, their building, trade, and agriculture achievements, the Aztecs seem rather advanced as ancient civilizations go. But all of it was blighted by their religion, by strange, superstitious beliefs, which sank into some of the worst excesses one can imagine. The religious rituals of the Aztecs sprang from their compulsive fears. They felt they must gratify and appease the various forces of nature which were beneficial to them, while at the same time they endeavored to repel the forces which were harmful. Most of the elements and various natural forces, such as the sun, rain, wind, fire, and so on, were worshipped as gods and goddesses. These idols adorned their massive pyramid stone temples. Inherent in our human nature is the offering of sacrifice to God, and so we find that sacrifice is a primary element in most of the ancient religious rites of most primitive peoples. The Aztecs were no different, but few offered sacrifice as did these Indians. The Aztecs felt themselves under an obligation to offer to their demon gods an almost continual stream of human blood, either in atonement for some calamity such as pestilence or earthquake, or to forestall some similar misfortune. For fear that the sun might not appear upon the morning horizon, they felt driven to supply the sun god with regular nourishment of human blood. The poor victims were usually slaves or prisoners of war, and the method of immolation was frightful in the extreme. The killings occasionally reached thousands in a single day. Tearing out the heart of living victims was relatively merciful compared to some of the other means of appeasement. Even little children were not spared. An early Mexican historian estimates that one child out of every five in Mexico was offered in sacrifice to the false gods. On the occasion of the building of a new temple in 1487, some 80,000 warriors were slaughtered in a single ceremony lasting 4 days and 4 nights, to the constant beating of giant drums made of snakeskin. How frightful such a sight and such a sound must have been. Even the hardened Spanish conquistadors were sickened by the sight of the Aztec priests covered with an ankle deep in the blood of their victims. It's easy to see how the missionaries, who followed close upon the heels of the Spanish conquistadors, regarded this horrible creed as an indication of satanic infestation. There's nothing in all of history so horrible which can begin to compare with this saga of slaughter, except for the 50 million abortions which have been performed in this country since 1973, amounting to 4,000 killings every day, and all to appease the Mother Goddess of the New Age. It was to these people of the Aztec Empire that the Franciscan missionaries came to convert. The missionaries had to try to make them understand the charity of a God-made man who shed his blood as a victim for all people in one great sacrifice of atonement. They taught the Indians that there's only one true God who created the world and made everyone in his own image and likeness. We must leave out a great deal in the telling of this part of the story, in which the missionaries were beset with great difficulties and opposition from the Spaniards themselves, many of whom gave a very poor example of Catholic living by abusing the Indians and thwarting the work of the Franciscans. But by God's grace, these holy religious succeeded in slowly bringing the light of the gospel to that blood-drenched land. Many of the newly converted Aztecs embraced the teachings of our holy faith with great simplicity and sincerity. Among the first converts was a sister of the Emperor Montezuma II, Princess Papancine, the royal princess who ruled over the principality of Totoloco. Some years before the coming of the Spaniards to Mexico, Princess Papancine had had a very strange dream while in a coma and close to death. In this dream, she saw herself standing on the shore of a great sea, guided there by what she described as an angel. As she watched, several galleons of enormous size appeared over the horizon and drew near. Black crosses adorned the sails of these ships, just like the cross on the forehead of her spirit guide. The angel told her that these ships were bringing men who were going to conquer her nation and bring the knowledge of the true God to all the Aztec peoples. The princess told her brother, the emperor, the details of her vision. Years later, both saw in Cortez's arrival to the New World the realization of this vision, which aided Montezuma's capitulation to the Spaniards. The angel had told the princess that she would be among the first to receive the waters that would wash away her sins. And so it was. Papancine was baptized in 1525, taking the name of Doña Maria. That very same year, a humble native couple of much lower descent received the same saving waters of baptism, taking the Christian names of Juan Diego and Maria Lucia. The princess died 4 years later in 1529, and so did Maria Lucia. Juan Diego, a convert of only 4 years, was now left a lonely widower. This unassuming little Indian is, as you know, the hero of our story. The year was 1531. It had only been 12 years since the mighty Montezuma surrendered to Hernando Cortez, and Spain took possession of the land for Christ the King. Juan Diego, now alone and childless, decided to move to Tolpetlac to be near his aged uncle, Juan Bernardino. Here he was only 9 miles from the larger city of Totoloco, where the friars had a church, and he could more easily care for his uncle, as well as attend the church services and catechism lessons. In between, Juan carried on his rustic life of cultivating corn and beans, and occasionally did some hunting. From the evidence we have, it appears that Juan Diego was a small man, friendly, but rather reserved, whose characteristic virtue seems to have been his humility. Quietly unassuming and inclined to shuffle along the road when walking, his life was, as for all in his class, a continual battle for survival. But Juan found solace in his Catholic faith, which he practiced very ardently. In the year 1531, Juan was still strong and robust, but beginning to feel his age. He was by this time 57 years old, and the 9-mile walk over the broad hills to Mass was beginning to tire him a little more now. December 9th, 1531, the day on which the Feast of the Immaculate Conception was then celebrated, was a Saturday that year. Juan rose early and, leaving his house in the cold starlight, began the long walk across the undulating country to assist at the Mass in honor of Our Lady. This particular feast was very special for him. The good Franciscan friars, who loved Our Lady very much, had explained to the Indians how the Mother of Christ had been conceived without the least stain of sin, because she had been redeemed by a special grace before all others in view of her Son's death on Calvary. She was the all-pure and all-shining one, who was also his very own mother. Juan felt less lonely as he quickened his pace. The stars paled above him, and he hurried along in the bitter cold, with the sharp stones cutting into his worn leathern sandals. Soon he approached the shoulder of the hill called Tepeyac. There it stood here, not that long ago, a pagan temple in honor of Mother Earth, a goddess with a head composed of loathsome snakes, a garment of writhing serpents, and a fearful countenance with sightless eyes. This hideous monster had been worshipped on this very spot as a giver of life and its devourer, mother of all the living things and the tomb of all. Juan shuddered and suddenly stood still. What was that he heard? Strains of soft music coming from somewhere, but where? Juan listened. Perhaps it was his imagination. But no, the music was unmistakably real and more beautiful than anything he had ever heard before. It was like the chorus of 1,000 birds filling the air with ravishing sweetness. Juan gazed up in wonderment at the dark outline of Tepeyac Hill from where this blissful harmony flowed down like liquid silver. To his amazement, he saw a glowing white cloud at the top, emblazoned by a brilliant rainbow of colors and light. Suddenly the music ceased, without the trace of an echo. Then he heard his name called, a gentle voice, a young girl's voice, sweet but insistent, pierced through him like a golden spear. Juanito, Juan Dieguito, the voice called affectionately, little Juan, very little Juan. Who could be calling him in such an affectionate way? Who would be on the top of this hill so early in the morning? The Indian was mystified and inwardly drawn towards the voice, thinking perhaps he had died and was now entering into the heaven of which the friars had often spoken. Unafraid, he began to clamber up the boulder-strewn slope. Upon reaching its 130-foot summit, Juan found himself face to face with a lady of overpowering brilliance and beauty. Her garments radiated sunbeams. The rocks on which her feet rested resembled an anklet of precious stones. The earth around her shone all the colors of the rainbow. The mesquite bushes, prickly pears, and scrubby plants around him glittered like emeralds with foliage as fine as turquoise. Even the cactus prickles gleamed like diamonds shining in the sun. Juan could hardly believe his eyes. This surely was like no dream he had ever had before. The beautiful lady before him was young, perhaps 14 years old, and was beckoning Juan to come closer. The Indian took a few steps, then sank to his knees, dazed by the supernatural loveliness of the apparition. She spoke again, and the sound was like nothing he had ever heard before. Juanito, the smallest of my children, where are you going? Her tone of voice was low and gentle, full of esteem and respect. Noble lady, I'm on my way to the church in Totoloco to hear Mass and continue the study of the divine mysteries taught us by the fathers. She continued to speak in her most sweet way, in the way one addresses someone greatly esteemed. She said, "Know for certain, dearest of my sons, that I am the perfect and perpetual Virgin Mary, Mother of the true God, the Lord of all, Master of heaven and earth, through whom all things live. I ardently desire that a temple be built here for me, here I will give all my love, all my compassion, all my help and protection to the people. I am your merciful mother, the mother of all who live united in this land, the mother of all mankind, of those who love me, of those who cry to me, of those who have confidence in me. Here I will hear their weeping and their sorrows, and I will remedy and alleviate their sufferings, necessities, and misfortunes. Therefore, in order that my wishes may be carried out, it's necessary that you go to the house of the bishop in Mexico City and tell him that I have sent you and that it is my desire to have a temple built for me here on this place. You shall tell him exactly what you have seen and heard. The bishop's house, Mexico City. The lady gazed compassionately upon Juan and said, "Be assured, littlest of my sons, that I shall be very grateful, and I shall reward you and make you happy for the work and trouble that you undertake for me. Now you have heard my words. Go and do everything as best as you can." Juan bowed very low and said reverently, "My holy one, my lady, I will do all you ask of me." Then he took leave of her and descended the rocky slope of Tepeyac and set off in rapt wonder towards Mexico City. What was asked of Juan would seem almost overwhelming. He, a poor Indian, had to find the bishop's house in the city, gain admission, convince Bishop Zumarraga of the truth of his story, and obtain from him a promise to build a church on top of Tepeyac Hill. He pondered, would the bishop's servants let him in? Would they set their dogs on him for disturbing the house at such an early hour? Would the bishop believe such a fantastic story? Who was he, Juan Diego, to go before such a great man? How suddenly uncomfortable Juan felt in his coarse clothing and lowly status. His heart trembled at the prospect which lay before him. But the vision said she was the mother of God, and she had entrusted him, Juan Diego, with this mission. He squared his shoulders and determined to see it through. Upon founding the house, he slowly and deliberately knocked on the door of the Episcopal residence. It was opened by his servant, who eyed him suspiciously. He respectfully requested to see the bishop. The servant, after some hesitation, ushered him into a patio and told him to sit down and wait. An hour dragged by. The keen wind cut into him like a knife. For Mexico City is 7,000 feet above sea level, and it was winter. Juan drew his cloak, or tilma, thin as it was, closer around his shivering body, rubbing his hands together to keep warm. At last, an official materialized in the doorway and announced that His Excellency was ready to see him. Bishop Zumarraga rose to greet his unusual visitor with his habitual kindness, for the bishop was a kind and good man, a learned Franciscan who had great zeal for the faith. He probably was not told how long the Indian had been kept waiting. Juan Diego knelt before the bishop, and endeavoring to overcome his timidity, began to explain the vision, the request, and all he had seen and heard, as the lady had said. The bishop regarded Juan carefully, noted his sincerity and simplicity, and listened to all he said. Gently, he laid his hand on Juan's shoulder, saying, "You must come again, my son, when I can hear you more at my leisure. I will reflect on what you have told me, and will take into consideration your good will and the earnest desire that caused you to come to me." Then he gave Juan a sign of dismissal. Although the Indian had half expected this, he was greatly dismayed, for he then found himself being escorted through the fine building, past all the officials who regarded him with contempt, and on out towards a dusty street. He felt he had failed. As Juan retraced his steps and drew near Tepeyac, he knew the lady would be waiting for him, and so she was. Falling to his knees, he poured out the miserable story of his failure. He ended with these words, "I beg you, noble lady, entrust this message to someone of importance, someone well known and respected, so that your wish will be accomplished, for I am only a lowly peasant, and you, my lady, have sent me to a place where I have no standing. Forgive me if I have disappointed you for having failed in my mission." It was not likely that the lady would change her mind after Juan had given his little speech. She smiled and said to him, "Listen to me, my dearest son, and understand. that I have many servants and messengers whom I could charge with the delivery of this message. But it's altogether necessary that you should be the one to undertake this mission, and through your mediation that it should be accomplished. I urge you to go again tomorrow morning to see the bishop. Tell him in my name and make him understand my desire. Repeat to him that it is I in person, the ever-Virgin Mary, the Mother of God, who send you. Gazing upon her beautiful face, Juan felt a surge of confidence. Holy Lady, I will not disappoint you, he said. I will gladly go at your command, even though once more I may not be believed. Tomorrow I shall return and give you an account of the bishop's response. Juan rose to his feet, bowed low, and took leave of the beautiful lady. The next day was similar to the first, only worse. Juan faced the suspicion and contempt of the servants, the long wait in the biting wind, and the bishop's startled surprise that he should come back so soon. Juan knelt down. He was tired and cold, and the long wait he endured suddenly overcame him. Tears started down his cheeks. The words just tumbled out of his mouth as he pleaded his cause once again. The bishop was embarrassed. He asked Juan to try and calm himself. Juan took a deep breath as the bishop began to ask him many questions. Where did Juan see the lady? What was she like? How long did she stay? And so on. Bishop Zumarraga noticed in all this cross-examination that Juan never once contradicted himself. His story was always the same. He was impressed, but not enough to launch the building of a church on the top of Tepeyac. How could he be sure it really was Our Lady? The bishop decided to do what any one of us would do in his place, ask for a sign. Juan felt better. This was some progress. What sign would Your Excellency desire? The bishop said he would leave that up to the lady. And with that, Juan was dismissed. As soon as he was gone, the bishop ordered several trusted aides to follow Juan carefully and observe where he went and to whom he spoke. This was done, the aides observing a discreet distance from Juan, yet keeping him in sight. Alas, when the Indian reached the hill of Tepeyac, he suddenly seemed to vanish from view. Annoyed, they returned to the bishop and told him that Juan was an impostor. The bishop said nothing. He decided to withhold his judgment, pending the outcome of his request for a sign. Meanwhile, Juan was again pouring out his sad tale to the lady. When his anguished voice was silent at last, she smiled her lovely smile and said tenderly, "That is very good, my little son. Return here tomorrow, and you will have the sign the bishop has requested. Then he will believe and no longer doubt or suspect you." Then she smiled even more beautifully and said, "Mark my words, my little son. I shall richly reward you for all the worry, work, and trouble you have undertaken in my behalf. You may go home now. Tomorrow I shall be waiting for you here." Juan felt light as a feather. Perhaps this time he wouldn't fail. At this point in the records of the apparitions, we find that the various accounts of the Guadalupan history conflict in only a small detail. One version has it that upon returning home that Sunday evening, Juan found his uncle Juan Bernardino succumbing to a very serious fever. The other story, less known but of equal weight, is that Juan could not find his uncle at all. Juan Bernardino was missing. This latter version tells us that after a long search, the old man was found face down at the edge of a nearby wood, fatally wounded by an arrow and near death. It seems that his elderly uncle had been aiding the missionaries in a pending insurrection against the Spanish, and now was mortally wounded. Juan Diego, sick with fear and grief, carried his uncle to his little house, unable to comprehend why this awful tragedy should have happened at the very moment of his encounter with the Mother of God. Thoughts raced through his mind. Was she really who she said she was, or was he a victim of hallucination? If she were truly the Mother of God, how could this have happened to him? Surely no loving mother would permit such an evil to befall him and his uncle. Was this the way he was to be rewarded for his service? Doubts such as these tormented Juan, leaving him no peace. We might also question why God allowed Juan to meet with such difficulty when simply trying to do what Our Lady asked of him. Such thoughts as these often enter our minds also. We ask, if we are doing the will of God and trying to be good, then why so many crosses and so much contradiction? Why is it sometimes the harder we try, the worse things go for us? We must always remember that God does have a plan. We must trust Him no matter what. Getting back to the apparitions, if this latter version is indeed the correct one, it sheds more light upon the subsequent events and makes Our Lady's words to Juan Diego all the more meaningful. The temptation to doubt her would explain why he failed to show up the next morning for the scheduled appointment, why he skirted around Tepeyac in an effort to avoid meeting her as he headed towards the city to fetch a priest for his uncle. Poor Juan Diego. See him hasten round the hill, trying not to be seen from the usual elevation where he thinks the lady may be waiting. Suddenly, he is startled to see her descending the summit and coming towards him, heading him off at the pass, so to speak. No getting out of it now. Overcome by shame and confusion, Juan prostrates himself before her and begins to mutter all sorts of silly things. My lady, why are you up so early? I trust you are well. I hope you slept well. Poor Juan. But the lady, who knows everything that is troubling us before we even tell her, already has her beautiful message prepared, along with her own plan for the whole picture, which most of the time we just don't see, do we? The beautiful words Our Lady then spoke were not meant for Juan Diego alone. They constitute the special gift, the signal grace of the Guadalupan apparitions. Here on Tepeyac Hill, to all her bewildered and troubled children, to all her children are trying so hard to do what is right and yet meet with nothing but opposition, failure, and cross upon cross, Our Lady does not open up the ground and display the horrors of hell. She does not predict famine, war, or the annihilation of nations. She isn't going to warn Juan Diego what will happen to him unless he amends his life. We have heard all these things at Fatima, Lourdes, and La Salette. But here, at Guadalupe, our Blessed Mother tells us what we need to hear when we feel we just can't go on anymore, and when everything seems at its worst. So listen carefully to Our Lady's words of December 12, 1531, as she speaks to all of us who live in this land. Hear, and let it penetrate into your heart, my dear little son. Let nothing discourage you, nothing depress you. Let nothing alter your heart or your countenance. Do not fear any illness or vexation, anxiety or pain. Am I not here, I who am your mother? Are you not under my shadow and protection? Am I not your fountain of life? Are you not in the crossing of my arms and the folding of my mantle? Is there anything else that you need? As the accounts declare, Juan Diego's uncle was cured at that very hour. After assuring him that his uncle was better, Our Lady asked Juan to go up the hill and pluck the roses he will find growing there. Roses in mid-December on the barren top of Tepeyac? Little Saint Bernadette Subaru, 3 centuries later, was commanded by the Lady of the Grotto to eat the herbs and drink the water at the bank of the Masa Biel. The child could find nothing but grungy weeds and a pool of mud. Nevertheless, she ate and washed herself as the lady had bidden. Simple faith, humble obedience, and the miraculous waters of Lourdes sprang up at her hand. Now, Juan Diego obeys Our Lady in the same simple faith, climbs the hill, and lo, roses. Beautiful Castilian roses are growing in the hard, frozen ground where nothing had ever grown but cactus, thorny plants, and thistles. Gingerly, he plucks as many of the fragrant flowers as he can, tying his tilma around his neck and using it as an apron. In spite of the sharp thorns and his frozen fingers, Juan's cloak is soon filled with the miraculous blooms. He hastens back to the lady, who rearranges them carefully with her own hands. Then she tells him, "My son, these flowers are the sign you are to take to the bishop. You are to tell him in my name that in them he will recognize my will and that he must fulfill it. You are my ambassador worthy of trust. Do not unfold your tilma or reveal its contents until you are in his presence. A very different Juan Diego now runs almost all the way to Mexico City. His heart is beating with joy as he carries the sign the beautiful lady has given him for the bishop. Now His Excellency will surely believe him. The sneers and insults of the servants no longer bother him. Juan waits patiently, holding the ends of his tilma tightly to himself, warding off the curious aides and officials who pluck at it to see what he is hiding. Some succeed in catching sight of the beautiful flowers, even smelling their wonderful perfume. When they try to snatch at them, the flowers seem to melt into the sides of the tilma, as if suddenly woven into the fabric. One of the servants now dashes off to report to the bishop that the persistent Indian is back, and this time is carrying something strange in his tilma. When Juan is finally admitted into the bishop's presence, he finds himself surrounded by a number of important personages, including the new governor of Mexico, Bishop Don Sebastian Ramirez. God had so arranged that these personages were to bear witness to all posterity of the miracle about to take place before their very eyes. Juan retells his story, the appearance of the lady, her words, the roses growing on Tepeyac, how she arranged them in his tilma and sent them as a sign the bishop had asked for. With that, Juan triumphantly releases the ends of his cloak and says, "Here they are. Receive them." The lovely floral bouquet cascades to the floor in a profusion of color and perfume. Bishop Zumarraga gazes down, momentarily speechless. The sign! Full of wonder, he lifts his eyes to the tilma, and at that instant there appears on it a glorious image of the Mother of Christ. For one electrifying moment, the eyes of every person in that hushed room are riveted on the glowing image. Then slowly they sink to their knees in awe and veneration. Meanwhile, Juan sees nothing from where he is standing, only the roses now scattered in disarray at his feet. Why is the bishop kneeling before him? Juan looks at his tilma to see what everyone is staring at. His eyes widen in amazement. The lady has put her very own picture on his cloak, on his tilma, his very own tilma. The bishop reverently unties it and tells Juan Diego how sorry he is for not believing him. The lady will have her chapel, her shrine. And with this stupendous miracle, the devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe and the conversion of the New World to Christianity began in earnest. In just 7 years from the day of this miracle, while the Protestant revolt in Europe was tearing at the heart of the Church and drawing thousands of her children to perdition, 8 million natives in Mexico received the saving waters of baptism. How did the image on the tomb of Juan Diego come to be called Our Lady of Guadalupe? According to historians, Our Lady herself gave this name to Juan's uncle when appearing to him. Old Juan Bernardino testified that he lay close to death, waiting for his nephew to bring a priest. A beautiful young lady appeared to him in a bright light, made him well, and told him that she had given a picture of herself to his nephew. This picture was to be enshrined in a chapel on the hill of Tepeyac. And she said to him, "Call me and call my image Santa Maria de Guadalupe, Holy Mary of Guadalupe." In the Indian language, Guadalupe means to crush the head of the serpent. There are so many reflections to be made here, and so much more of the story that remains to be covered. The meaning of the picture to the natives and the truths of the faith that her very image conveyed to them. The miracle of the tilma itself and its preservation in such perfect condition after nearly 500 years. The mystical symbolism of her garments and of the entire image. The spirituality it conveys and its influence upon the men and women of the Americas for nearly 5 centuries. How scientists and artists try to explain the way the image is painted upon the tilma. Its colors, proportions, details, the enlarged photographs of her eyes, the scientific examinations which reveal such startling evidence that Our Lady is really gazing upon her children. All of it is so wonderful that a conference of an entire month's length would still fall short of what could be said, what could be learned of the Guadalupan image and story. There's a fair plethora of books, periodicals, research material, scientific investigation, sworn testimony, all of it so intriguing to the historian. But what in a few words are we to take away from this particular talk? Well, it seems to me that Guadalupe has a very special message for us all. We live in an age of very great material, scientific and technological advancement, yet we are surrounded by a neo-paganism which has infiltrated our entire society, even our church. The knowledge of the true religion, the worship of the one true God, is quickly disappearing from the face of the earth. It seems that Western civilization itself is collapsing before our very eyes. The night of faith in which we are all engulfed grows darker by the moment with every sin and blasphemy and perversion which raises its fist in God's face. There are so many idols, so many false gods that our moderns so desperately try to please, sacrificing everything they have. Our economic world seems to lie on the brink of disaster. It's, according to all the signs, a perfect setting for the coming of the Antichrist foretold by St. Paul. And the battle lines are being tightly drawn between the forces of good and the powers of hell. We're living during a pivotal point in the history of mankind. Our earthly life is very short. Although empires, dynasties, and civilizations come and go, the salvation of souls, the salvation of our own soul, remains the single most important and urgent thing we must accomplish by the time we die. Listen to these words again. I am your merciful mother, the mother of all who live in this land. Our Lady has not left her image in such a way anywhere else in the world. Since we live in America, she is our mother in a very unique way. Our Lady loves us specially, like a favorite child. She did not leave such an image to the Catholics of Europe, who had the faith long before we did. Our Blessed Mother left it here for us in a most special way. As the beautiful words of her feast day Mass tell us, I have chosen and sanctified this place that my name may be there, and that my eyes and my heart may remain there forever. He, referring to God, has not done in like manner to every nation. Through our daily disappointments, frustrations, irritations, anxieties, sorrows, fear, and pains, let us always recall Our Lady's most comforting words. We must trust in her motherly love and care for us, for she has said, hear and let it penetrate into your heart. Let nothing discourage you, nothing depress you. Let nothing alter your heart or your countenance. Do not fear any illness or vexation, anxiety or pain. Am I not here, I who am your mother? Are you not under my shadow and protection? Am I not your fountain of life? Are you not in the crossing of my arms and the folding of my mantle? Is there anything else that you need?